Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
In for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. Analysts reviewing the health of the nation's economy are poring over the latest numbers. The National Association of Realtors reported today that sales of existing homes in November fell 1.7%. And the Labor Department said unemployment applications were up slightly last week. On the plus side, consumer confidence rose to its highest level since the summer, and holiday sales were up a couple of percentage points over last year. Still, some economists are concerned about a possible recession. Joining us with his take on the numbers is Jim Cooper. He's Business Outlook columnist for Business Week magazine. Welcome, Jim.
Thanks, Deborah. Nice to be here.
Is it fair to say that the economy's holding steady right now, could be stronger? How would you describe it?
I would describe it as doing a little better than holding steady. I think in the fourth quarter, the economy is doing a lot better than anyone had thought, given everything that was thrown at it in the summer in terms of higher energy costs and the hurricanes. And it looks like, based on the data that we're seeing through the end of the quarter, that the economy is actually gaining some momentum heading into the first quarter of next year. And I fully believe that growth in the first quarter of next year will actually be a slightly better than the growth that we're going to see reported for the fourth quarter. So, yeah, I think we're doing very well heading into the new year.
Even though energy prices are high and even though the home sale numbers are down somewhat.
Well, home sales are not really down that much when you consider where the level has been through the year. In addition, I don't think you would expect any kind of dire collapse in the housing market with interest rates where they are right now. Mortgage rates should stay around the 6% level, maybe slightly higher. And as you know, that's the most important factor in housing demand. And unless mortgage rates go much higher than that, you're really not going to get any kind of serious damage done to the housing sector, although every sign does point to the fact that housing is, in fact, topping out right now.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it will still be a primary indicator of the economy? I know today's Wall Street Journal says mortgage applications are down.
Mortgage applications are down over the past few weeks, I agree, but from a very high level again. Like I said, the most important factor to look at there, I think, is mortgage rates in addition to the fact that the labor markets are in very good shape. I think that's one of the reasons why consumer confidence has rebounded to a very high level. We saw very good job growth in November. When the December report comes out next week, I think we'll see another very good gain in job growth. And that's generating income for consumers, and that's one of the reasons that they're able to offset these higher energy costs.
Mm-hmm. Some economists have said that because of what's happening with Treasury yields, that there could be a recession.
Well, I think that's a little bit too dire for what the yield curve is saying. They're talking about the fact that short-term rates are threatening to rise above long-term rates, and that's a condition called an inverted yield curve. And that's what got the stock market kind of all in a tither on Monday. But we had two inverted yield curves, one in 1995 and one in 1998, and they signified absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering then, as we look at the past year, as we look at 2005, your assessment is what it was at the beginning here, is that economy is strong and you predict that it will get even stronger and things are really going well.
Well, it's really sort of amazing when you look back at, like I said at the top, what has been thrown at this economy in 2005 and how it has been so resilient, especially how consumers have been so resilient. And I think a lot of the factors that helped consumers in 2005 will also be helping them in 2006. You know, they still have a tremendous amount of wealth built up in their homes. Job growth is picking up. Income growth is actually accelerating now because the job market is improving. So I think, you know, the old axiom is that so go consumers, so goes the economy. And I think that's a big reason to expect at least another fairly good performance in 2006.
All right. Well, Jim, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Well, it was a pleasure, Deborah.
Jim Cooper is a columnist for Business Week magazine. We ordinarily spend our time in the here and now, but today we'd like to take a look into the future with Ray Kurzweil. Kurzweil has been called a modern Edison. He invented the first print-to-speech reading machine for the blind and the first text-to-speech synthesizer. Back in the early 90s, he predicted a worldwide computer network, the dominance of intelligent weapons in warfare, and the defeat of a human chess champion by a computer, all of which have come to pass. Now, Ray Kurzweil is saying in the near future, blood cell-sized robots called nanobots will repair us internally. His vision is laid out in a book that came out this year called The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. This past summer, Kurzweil was in our studios to talk with Robin Young.
What is the singularity you've been speaking of?
Well, we are the species that seeks to go beyond our limitations. I mean, that's really the unique thing about humans. And biology actually is very limiting. Our interneuronal connections, for example, think at chemical switching speeds of a few hundred feet per second, and electronics is already a million times faster. Mm. And ultimately, we're going to get very intimate with our technology. We're already putting things in our pockets. We'll have computers in our clothing in a few years. And as we get to the 2020s, intelligent nanobots, robots the size of blood cells, will make their way into our bloodstream. They'll keep us healthy by destroying pathogens, removing debris, correcting DNA errors. And they'll go into our brains and actually augment our thinking and actually expand our analytical capabilities.
Is this the same as transhumanism?
That's related. I actually don't like that word because, in my mind, we're not transcending our humanity. This is what it is to be human, is to go beyond our limitations. We're going to transcend our biology. So I prefer trans-biological. Mm. If it sounds very futuristic, I'd point out a couple of early examples. We're already putting blood cell-sized devices in the bloodstream of animals and curing major diseases. One scientist actually cured type 1 diabetes with that type of device. Very cleverly lets out insulin in a controlled fashion and so on.
I just want to be careful with that because when you say cure, you have to live with the device because in type 1 diabetes you can't produce insulin, so the device does?
Right, but it becomes part of that animal. I mean, it's traveling in their bloodstream. So these are early experiments today, but by the 2020s these will be routine technologies. We have neural implants, computers inside people's brains that allow you to actually download new software to your neural implant from outside the patient. This is an FDA-approved neural implant for Parkinson's disease. So this is technology we have today. You can't introduce that through the bloodstream. That requires surgical implementation, but that's today's technology. If we go out to the 2020s, we will be able to introduce these various advanced technologies non-invasively through the bloodstream and really extend our physical and mental capabilities.
And one of the reasons you and others believe so that this is going to happen is because of how technology has exponentially exploded.
Right, and this is not a casual observation of mine. I became an ardent student of technology trends because of my interest in being an inventor, and I realized most technology projects fail because the timing is wrong. And I've built mathematical models of how technology evolves. I have a team of 10 people that gathers data on key measures of many different technologies and many different aspects of technology, not just computers, are growing exponentially. For example, the cost of sequencing a base pair of DNA comes down by half every year. The amount of DNA data we collect doubles every year. It took us 15 years to sequence HIV. We sequenced SARS in 31 days, and there are hundreds of examples like that. And people say, well, you know, you can't predict the future. Turns out there are certain things that you can predict very reliably.
So what are you saying, Ray Kurzweil, again, getting back to the singularity, what are you saying that that means? You said it doesn't mean transcending humanity. It's still a human, but what, completely mind-melded with technology?
Essentially. Technology is growing by a factor of 1,000 every decade. Within 25 years, it'll be almost a billion-fold increase in the power of these electronic technologies as well as biological technology. We're reverse engineering our biology. The old drug paradigm was to just find something that happened to work and it had all kinds of side effects. We're now actually understanding the information processes underlying our biology and gaining the means to reprogram them. Mm. We have 23,000 little software programs called genes inside us, and conditions are different today. So one gene, for example, the fat insulin receptor gene, says hold on to every calorie because the next hunting season may not work out so well. That was a great program 30,000 years ago when calories are few and far between. We'd like to turn that off. What happens if you turn that off? Well, we have a new technology called RNA interference, which allows us actually to turn selectively genes off. when that gene was turned off in mice, these mice ate ravenously and remained slim and got the health benefits of being slim and lived 20% longer. And that's just one of the 23,000 genes that we could reprogram as we're actually gaining the means of essentially reprogramming our biology.
Right. You're saying, in essence, we could download a new software gene program into our bodies and have our genes respond in a different way.
There's two overlapping revolutions. One is the biotechnology revolution, where we're gaining the means through these types of drugs, RNA interference to turn off specific genes, gene therapy, where we'll be able to add new genetic information, the ability to suppress enzymes, and really reprogram these information processes based on these biological processes. The other is nanotechnology, where we'll be able to put these little robots, nanorobots the size of blood cells, into our bloodstream. They'll go inside our body and carry out sort of complex missions to enhance our health. Mm. So whatever, and that's a little bit later. So whatever we don't get around to fixing with biotechnology, the nanobots, nanotechnology, will be able to repair.
Well, Ray Kurzweil, as you know, there are some people who think that this thinking is just wacko. And I know you know that. A bioethics professor at Yale, Sherwin Nuland, I'll paraphrase what he says. He says that people like you who make these kinds of statements are brilliant people who don't want to die, that it distorts your rational thinking because you so much want to live and be immortal.
My predictions are not based on fantasy or desire. They're based on sort of rational examination of where these trends are headed. Mm. We'll have very detailed models of all the information processes underlying our biology within 10 to 15 years and the means of reprogramming them to stop and slow down and even reverse aging and disease processes.
Mm. Well, in fact, you talk about bridges, three bridges to immortality, or as you will, to slowing down the aging process. The first, a health regimen, which you yourself undertook when you were diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. This is the one more associated with lifestyle.
That's right. I mean, I cured my type 2 diabetes through lifestyle, nutrition, nutritional supplements. You really can.
Wait, nutritional supplements, how many a day?
I take about 200 a day.
And what is your goal? To be able to live long enough to see this singularity come true?
Among other things. I mean, the regime I'm following is we call Bridge 1, which is to slow down aging processes, overcome your genetic predispositions to disease, which you really can. The whole purpose of Bridge 1 is really just to be in good shape 10 or 15 years from now when we have the sort of full blossoming of this biotechnology revolution. And that's Bridge 2, which will bring us to Bridge 3 20 years from now, the nanotechnology revolution, nanorobots going inside our bloodstream, mm-hmm. which really will be able to provide sort of radical life extension, dramatic increases in our longevity.
That's author, inventor, and futurist Ray Kurzweil speaking with Robin Young. Their conversation will continue after a short break. Also, later in the show, the year in pictures from Time magazine. There's more coming up. Stay with us here and now. It's Here and Now. We've been listening to an interview with Ray Kurzweil, whose many books include The Age of Intelligent Machines, The Age of Spiritual Machines, and Fantastic Voyage, Live Long Enough to Live Forever. His newest book is titled The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. It describes a world where nanobots travel in our bloodstreams, repairing us and our DNA from the inside. Some critics say this technology will only benefit those who can pay for it. Robin Young interviewed Kurzweil and asked him if this could further increase the divide between the haves and the have-nots.
A key feature of this technology, which I call the law of accelerating returns, is really a 50% deflation per year. I mean, you can buy the same digital camera today as you could buy a year ago for half the price. These technologies, anything having to do with information, comes down by half each year. And it's true also of these medical technologies. AIDS drugs used to cost $30,000 per person per year. You can now buy them in Africa for $100 or $200 per person per year. Technology like this starts out unaffordable. Only the rich can afford them. And at that stage, they don't work. Then a few years later, they work a little bit better, and they're merely very expensive. Then a few years go by, They're inexpensive and work quite well, and ultimately they're almost free, and then they work extremely well. And that is a 10-year progression from early adoption of unaffordable technologies that don't work to late adoption of really ubiquitous technologies. So we ultimately will be able to meet the physical needs of even an expanded human population, which increases in our longevity will create.
Well, sure, and that's the other question. I mean, you say expanded populations, but how you're talking about immortality. And
still,
already there aren't enough resources. So,
right, but there are nano-engineered designs already for solar panels that would be very efficient, lightweight, and inexpensive. If we captured 0.03% of the sunlight that falls on the Earth, we can meet our projected energy needs for the year 2030. And then we can store that energy in nano-engineered fuel cells, which will be highly decentralized, so get away from these centralized technologies like liquid natural gas tankers and atomic energy plants. So we'll be able to ultimately meet our energy needs very inexpensively through these renewable resources.
In your last book, I mentioned A Fantastic Voyage. You and your co-author write about the need for this thinking almost as if it's some sort of moral imperative, that you want to save lives. Where does God fit into that equation, and the idea that life is an arc and that death is a part of life in many faiths?
Well, death may be natural, but not all natural things are good. And in my view, death is a tragedy. It's a tremendous loss of personality, skills, knowledge, relationships. We've rationalized it as a good thing because that's really been the only alternative we've had. But we'd really have the opportunity to go beyond our limitations, overcome suffering. I think it is a moral imperative to overcome suffering.
Do you believe in God? I just wonder about that.
Well, I think evolution, which I talk a lot about in The Singularity Is Near, you can view as a spiritual process. Because what happens when systems of energy and matter evolve? If we look at biological evolution and technological evolution, they become more complex. Systems become more knowledgeable. They actually become much more intricate and more beautiful. They become more capable of higher emotions like love. So they grow exponentially in beauty, love, knowledge, intelligence, creativity, all of the things that people ascribe to God. I mean, God is a word. What does it mean? It means an unlimited amount of these things, creativity, intelligence, love. Well, evolution ultimately provides that by growing exponentially in just these kind of qualities that we attribute to God. So that's a spiritual perspective on the idea of evolution.
I think it's time for the lightning round. I was speaking to Ray Kurzweil, who has predicted so many things in the past that have since come true. So we want to take a look at the future with you. What do you see as the future of personal computers?
We have information processes inside our bodies and brains. Something I talk about extensively in The Singularity Is Near is reverse engineering the brain, understanding how it works. And ultimately, we'll be able to replicate them and create very human-like machines that are non-biological.
Oh, you get to that God question again. You know, as
well, it brings up the other issue of spirituality, which is, what is the ultimate sort of spiritual value is consciousness. Right now, we can distinguish machines from humans because even if a machine pretends to be a human, let's say in a video game, the simulation is brittle. It doesn't have all the convincing, subtle cues of real human intelligence. But that distinction is going to go away as we get to 2030. There won't be a clear distinction between non-biological intelligence and biological intelligence.
What do you see as the future of music?
Well, we're creating cybernetic musicians that will be able to jam with you, musicians that understand your style in jazz or rock or whatever, and accompany you, compute the right walking bass line and drum accompaniments.
What do you see in travel?
Well, the biggest thing in travel is the ability to travel virtually. I'm actually the only speaker in the world that has this three-dimensional virtual reality technology. It's called Teleportech, where I can appear three-dimensionally at another venue. We have to send out a technician with the other end of the equipment, which looks like a podium, and it looks to the audience like I'm standing behind a podium. But I look three-dimensional. I look life-size. It's full immersion. It's quite realistic. Yeah, I've got this installed in my office.
Are you really here?
I'm really here. people have been convinced I was really there, and I can see them as well. As we get to the early part of the next decade, 2010, 2012, this will be a routine part of our cell phone, except the phone won't be a physical object. We'll be writing images directly to our retinas from our eyeglasses and lenses, which will create full immersion virtual reality. So the kind of experience you and I are having now, where we can look at each other and look around each other, we'll just be able to do with images written directly to our retina, but it'll feel like we're together, at least as far as visual and auditory virtual reality is concerned.
That's author and futurist Ray Kurzweil. He was talking with Robin Young about his new book, The Singularity Is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we're back in the present with a look at major changes to Medicare prescription drug benefits that go into effect this weekend. We speak with one woman who says there's still massive confusion and many of the nation's elderly need help. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now.
Rebecca, in for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. Mapping the course of human civilization has been the life work of UCLA geography professor Jared Diamond. He first gained international fame with his 1997 Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, The Fates of Human Societies. It outlines his theory that Europeans came to dominate the globe mainly because of circumstances and luck. Diamond's bold ideas were the result of a 30-year quest that started in New Guinea when a man there, named Yali, asked him why white men had so much cargo or material possessions while New Guineans had so little.
When I started out in New Guinea in 1964, I was really naive and I thought, okay, these are primitive people. And it took me about 12 hours to discover that although they had stone tools, there's nothing primitive about them mentally, and they're as smart and alert and curious as Japanese and Europeans and Americans. And for 15 years, I didn't have any idea until in the late 1980s it began to dawn on me. This was all connected to the rise of complex societies with food surpluses that could feed inventors and kings and bureaucrats. So it all had to do with the rise of agriculture.
Diamond proposed that both geography and the environment played major roles in determining the shape of the modern world, and he expanded on his theories in his latest book, Collapse: How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed. The book questions whether the modern world could suffer the same fate of past societies that died off at the height of their success. We spoke with Professor Diamond earlier this year, and he started by telling us how he traced the fall of different societies.
The Fertile Crescent, in effect, committed ecological suicide, not intentionally, but inadvertently, because it's a low rainfall environment subject to deforestation and soil erosion and salinization. And that's why the Fertile Crescent lost its enormous head start to the ecologically more robust European peninsula.
Now, you identify five major causes of societal collapse: environmental damage, climate change, hostile neighbors, loss of trade partners, and plain stupidity, which we seem to have in abundance. Let's pick one of the peoples that you pick in the book, the case of the Norse in Greenland. What led to their downfall?
In Greenland, the Norse did not have guns, germs, and steel because of the distance from Europe. They were fighting it out with the Inuit on a basis of equality with the same bows and arrows and spears that the Inuit had. And by about 1440, every Norseman and Norsewoman was dead, and the Inuit took over Greenland, and they've been there ever since. That's as close as you can get to a controlled experiment to see whether Europeans have any intrinsic superiority.
And another area you focus on, Easter Island, a society that lived and died in almost complete isolation. It's so fascinating because of some of the relics that are left. What lessons can we draw from Easter Island, in your opinion?
Easter Island in the year 1680 is a metaphor for a worst-case scenario of the world today. Easter Island is an isolated island in the Pacific Ocean, 2,300 miles off the coast of Chile. Its inhabitants, Polynesians, are famous for the gigantic stone statues weighing up to 80 tons that they erected without any metal tools or wheels. Quite an achievement. And they chop down trees like everybody else, but Easter Island is a dry, cool place where if you chop down trees, the trees don't grow back fast enough to replace the ones you've chopped down. So around 1680, the Easter Islanders have chopped down the last tree, which meant that they run out of wood to make canoes, to go out to sea to harpoon fish. They also ran out of wood to erect their statues, and East Rhode Island society collapsed in an epidemic of cannibalism. Everybody sees that this is a metaphor for the planet Earth today. If we get into severe trouble by messing up our own world the way the East Rhode Island has messed up East Rhode Island, there isn't going to be any galaxy that we can flee to either, and there aren't going to be any nice green extraterrestrials who come help us out, just as with the East Rhode Islanders.
But as you know, there are some people who say there may be galaxies that we flee to. And unlike Easter Island, societies aren't isolated. And that's been a criticism of your fear that the world may be near a crisis point now, that we're in a different time and that the world seems to rally just at the point when it's needed in times of crisis.
Yeah, wouldn't it be nice if that were true? Greg Easterbrook, in his New York Times review of my book, complained that I had a short-term view. I was worried about the next 50 or 100 years, when 10,000 years from now we'll be colonizing other galaxies. Well, I would say to Greg Easterbrook and his children, that's very comforting that 10,000 years from now, if you have any descendants, they'll be on other galaxies. I'm concerned about, and everybody else except you on Earth is concerned about, what's going to happen to us and our children in the next 50 years.
Well, there's so much else that you write that you're concerned about, including global population. But despite everything you write in your books, you describe yourself as cautiously optimistic. And I'm wondering, how can that be? Because after I read them, I think they're cause for alarm.
I'm cautiously optimistic because of you. And I mean that. You meaning the media today, because of global communication. The whole world today has the ability to find out what's happening in other parts of the world. And also, here we are talking about archaeology and societies 8,000 years ago. We can learn about societies of the past. But the Easter Islanders, when they chopped down the last tree in 1680 on their island, they had no way of knowing about the successful reforestation going on in Japan in 1680, nor did the Easter Islanders know that the Maya had messed up by chopping down their trees around the year 800. So what makes me cautiously optimistic is that we're the first society today in world history with the potential for learning from societies remote from us in space and remote from us in time.
It's funny, you know, we started, Professor, by learning about how you started in Papua New Guinea, answering a question that a man asked you, why is it that Westerners have more cargo, more things, more weapons than he did? That sent you on your exploration of why some cultures got guns and steel and things like that, while Papua New Guinea remains, backward, if you will. But I'm wondering, then, as I read the pages of your second book, Collapse, as these huge cultures collapsed, the ones who had a lot of cargo, I'm wondering if you think in the end the fellow in Papua New Guinea might be more likely to survive.
That's up for grabs, and that depends entirely on the decisions that we make. It's not inevitable that modern society will collapse or even go downhill. It is the case that Americans today, the mass of Americans, are more concerned than at any time in my lifetime about where the world is going and what is happening to the United States today. And the United States faces more difficult problems today, even though we are the world's richest country. The dangers to us are things that we are doing ourselves.
Jared Diamond, a UCLA geography and physiology professor, author of the best-selling Guns, Germs, and Steel, The Fates of Human Societies, and its sequel, Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed. Professor, what's next now that you've done the rise and fall of world history?
I'm just starting to work on a new book, which is going to take me another 7 years to finish. So that's what's next.
Any hint?
There'll be something about New Guinea in the new book, and I think that's as much as I can safely say at the moment.
Well, Professor Diamond, I can't wait to hear about it. Thanks so much.
You are welcome. Glad to talk with you.
That's author and Professor Jared Diamond speaking with Robin Young earlier this year. Still to come, Time Magazine's picks for the best pictures of 2005. You're listening to Here and Now. Hall of Fame basketball players Bill Russell and Wilt Chamberlain waged a 10-year battle for supremacy in the National Basketball Association. It was one of the longest-running confrontations in sports, but Russell's teams won 9 NBA titles and Chamberlain's teams captured just one, even though his individual stats were better. The Russell-Chamberlain story is told in a new book called The Rivalry: Bill Russell and Wilt Chamberlain and the Golden Age of Basketball. Its author is John Taylor, who recently spoke with Only a Game's Bill Littlefield.
The shorthand evaluation of these two players was that Wilt Chamberlain was interested in breaking records and Bill Russell was interested in winning championships. To what extent is that generalization fair?
Well, it's fair, but it's also superficial. I mean, there's no question that Chamberlain was at the time, and I think still is, the greatest athlete, physical athlete, that the game has ever seen. Russell, however, was a much more psychological player, and he understood in a way that Chamberlain never did that basketball was a team sport, and he was willing to do whatever it took to make the team win, and Chamberlain simply didn't have that kind of focus.
Perhaps the most dramatic matchup between Chamberlain and Russell occurred in the 1969 NBA Finals. Would the two men have been understood differently if the Lakers had prevailed in Game 7 of that series?
I think so. It's one of the great games in basketball history and one of the most dramatic. It was Bill Russell's last game, even though he hadn't told anyone he was retiring. The Celtics had been seen as complete underdogs going into the series. They barely even made it into the playoffs. Chamberlain was playing with Jerry West and Elgin Baylor, and in a sense, the Lakers had too much talent. They had great difficulty adjusting to Chamberlain. Chamberlain didn't get along with his coach. So the whole series, the whole season, the whole 10-year rivalry came down to this final game and this one moment. This one decision, there was about 3 or 4 minutes left to play, and Chamberlain hurt himself, fell down and hurt his knee, and asked to be taken out of the game. You know, everyone who was watching was appalled. I mean, this was, you know, the championship was at stake. The Celtics had a saying that during the playoffs there were no injuries. If you could walk, you could play. I mean, there were other players. Jerry West was limping. Elgin Baylor's knees were killing him. Russell had the terrible shin splints, and they were all playing. And suddenly Chamberlain, with the championship at stake, asked to be taken out. The Lakers had trailed the entire game. And then with Chamberlain on the bench and a young guy named Mel Counts playing center, the Lakers suddenly surged and began to catch up to the Celtics. And when that happened, Chamberlain decided he wanted to go back in the game, and he asked his coach, Van Bredekhoff, to be put back in. And so at that point, Van Bredekhoff had a decision to make. Did he put his star center back in, a man who was considered, you know, the greatest basketball player in history, or did he keep him on the bench and go with the team that seemed to be overtaking the Celtics? So he decided to leave Chamberlain on the bench. The Lakers ended up fading, and they lost the championship by 2 points.
Have any subsequent rivalries in the NBA matched or exceeded Russell versus Chamberlain?
Well, people like to talk about the Larry Bird Magic Johnson rivalry, but this was not just two guys playing against each other. I mean, this was a rivalry that changed the way basketball was played. They changed the way each other played. I mean, each pushed the other to become a much greater player than either of them would have been, you know, without their counterpart. And you know, Bill Russell recognized that. He was really disturbed by Chamberlain's death a few years ago, and at the memorial service, he said that the two of them would always be bonded in eternity.
That's John Taylor, author of The Rivalry: Bill Russell, Wilt Chamberlain, and the Golden Age of Basketball. He spoke with Only a Game's Bill Littlefield. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. here and now. The year moves on and one story gets replaced by another in the churn of the news cycle. We may forget some of the headlines, but often the images stay with us. The bleak, flattened landscape where an Indonesian family once lived. The distressed faces pushing through a crowd at the New Orleans Superdome. Fingers stained purple in Iraq. Robin Young spoke with Time magazine photo editor Marianne Golan, who sorted through the year's images for Time's annual Best Photos issue. And listeners, you can link to these images by going to our website, here-now.org. Here's Robin.
You know, it just feels as if 2005, especially as we look at the year in review and pictures, was marked by natural disasters.
It certainly was. I mean, when we were going through the material this year, one of the things that struck us most was the fact that normally it's up close and personal. It's, you know, the struggle on the faces, as you mentioned, or the purple finger. And this year seemed to us to almost be the year of the landscape because of all the natural disasters we've suffered.
The flooded landscape in particular. Let's look first at New Orleans. We've done whole segments on the pictures that came out of New Orleans. You've included one we want to talk about, Thomas Dorzak's shot of a man's body floating under the I-10 overpass.
Yes, it's an extraordinary image. Over 1,100 people now have died as a result of Hurricane Katrina, and it's only an image of one. But it's so horrifying in a way. There's a food store. You know, we're under what's clearly the overpass of I-10. And for anybody who's ever seen Elysian Fields, you never expect to see somebody laying in the middle of the street like that.
It's
quite shocking. When I ask people very frequently within the industry and even outside the industry about what they remember about certain events, I'm always struck by the fact that they say, oh, I remember this picture or I remember that picture. It's not a specific moment in time unless it's somehow been frozen that way for them, and then it imprints on our brains in some sort of way.
By the way, you know, there were so many pictures from Katrina that many of us, you know, found ourselves looking at the ones that you picked and said, yeah, I remember that, but what about this one? I mean, but it just reminds me that what a hard job to pick.
Well, it's just incredibly subjective, Robin. I mean, it's amazing that it's completely the judgment of the editors, both the photo editors but also the editors of Time magazine, of what we thought were the most important images of the year, and then applying all the standards that you apply as well in terms of, you know, the way they're composed and lighting, and but most importantly that the images were images that represented the history of 2005, the most important events of this year. And one of the things that photography is able to do is to bring these far-flung places home.
Well, like Pakistan, I'm looking at the picture it's a body of a student almost becoming part of the earth that he's buried in silt after the earthquake in Pakistan. This picture was taken in Balakot by Thomas Munita.
Actually, for the first moment when you look at it, most people say they see the hands before they see the face, but it's just such an extraordinary image.
I'm looking, too, at as you said, there are a lot of tragic photos, and another one is Jan Grarup's photograph of an emaciated mother lying on the ground with her child almost nursing himself. This is in the Darfur region of Sudan, one of the most undercovered stories of the year, we think we can safely say. But just, you know, in this photograph, it just jumps out at you.
Oh, it's like a painting. I mean, when you first look at it, it seems a beautiful scene. And then at second glance, it's a tragic scene, but it's so beautifully composed. It reminded me of traditional paintings of mothers and children.
Except she has a dazed, far-off look in her eyes. And as you said, as you look closer, you see the anguish there. There are also some photographs showing a side of the Iraq War that we don't really get to see. There's James Notway's photograph of Army Specialist Matthew Braddock, who's sitting on a doctor's table, holding up his own leg, sort of examining the stump where his, you know, lower leg has been amputated.
It's an incredible image. I think the thing that's really amazing, too, is that James Noctway, who's a longtime contract photographer for Time magazine, was himself injured in 2003 in Iraq, and he was very interested in the story. And I thought the sensitivity with which he made this photograph is extraordinary. There's no way you can't help but feel what he's feeling.
Yeah. Yes, a soldier staring straight on at something a lot of Americans don't want to see. Speaking of which, we haven't seen a lot of pictures of coffins returning from Iraq. That was a huge news story in and of itself, that the Pentagon was not allowing coffins to be photographed. You have one. It's taken from outside of an airplane, which is arriving in Reno, Nevada. On the upper level, passengers are looking out their windows, staring at what's happening below, which is Marines draping the coffin of Second Lieutenant James Cathy, who'd been killed in the war, and, you know, taking his body off of this airplane.
We haven't seen a lot of returns of fallen Marines. I mean, there was a time, I remember years ago, we saw just a field of flag-draped coffins when bodies were returning from an earlier conflict. You know, I believe it was Grenada, you know, the invasion of Grenada. And there was a conscious decision made that this was an image that people didn't need to see. And I beg to differ, obviously, but this photograph by Todd Heisler was extraordinary, because you can imagine, when you look at the picture, first you notice the flag underneath and the draping of the flag over the fallen Marine's coffin. But then you can imagine being the people in the plane, because they had no idea until they arrived at the airport and the cargo hold is opened and they see an honor guard standing outside their plane, that actually this is a plane carrying a fallen Marine.
What I love about the picture is that the windows act as picture frames, and in each,
yes,
of the frames is a face looking out at you. What are you looking for when you look through these photographs?
Well, I think we're looking for a narrative, you know, a sort of experience of holding this in your hand and leafing through it. And although it's very dark, that it's a way to reflect on what's happened and to give our readers an opportunity to remember, you know, just what a year 2005 was.
Some of the other pictures concern the London bus bombing, the evacuation of Israeli settlers from Gaza, the Paris riots. Well, I'm wondering, as I leaf through, is there one lovely moment? There's the Pope.
I think there's several. I think that one of the pictures that moves me very much is the picture by Tim Hetherington of the Muslim schoolgirls on the beach in Sri Lanka. And one of the things that I found very heart-wrenching after the tsunami was that many people who had lived and worked by the sea were afraid of the ocean and wouldn't go near it. And this is a sort of late afternoon photograph of a class of Muslim schoolgirls, you know, sort of frolicking in the waves. And for me, that was a very hopeful image. It seemed like a joyful picture to me.
Marianne Golan, photo editor at Time Magazine, talking about the best photos of 2005 in a special issue. You can find a link to the pictures we've been talking about and also vote for your favorite picture of the year at our website, here-now.org. Marianne, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Robin.
That's Here and Now's Robin Young speaking with Time Magazine photo editor Marianne Golan. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Oh, there's girls laughing, smiling so pretty, those sweet girls laughing. Shuffling the world underneath. It's all along to a sweet Cajun song, drinking and jiving till dawn. I could dance on and on, doing a two-step in my sweet Lafayette. Take me back, Lafayette, way down on the bayou.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Deborah Be-